1, 2, 3. Welcome to Encore Nutrition, 2 Ps in a podcast, a show that simplifies the overwhelming world of health and nutrition with evidence-based science.
We're Elise and Lauren, your accredited practicing dietitians, empowering you with the knowledge and strategies to make real change today. This week, we're breaking down why diets don't work.
But don't despair, we'll also tell you what actually does.
When it comes to dieting, everyone is always looking for a quick fix, and there is so many conflicting opinions. Should we go low carb, high carb, keto, low fat, low sodium, and the list goes on.
Absolutely. And I think it's quite human nature that we tend to want a quick fix.
Yeah.
We want to lose weight now. We want shiny hair now. We want everything
now.
And that, I think, is a product of our society as well as just human psychology. Yeah. And so when something is presented that promises to give you that quick fix, it's very appealing.
Very easy to get lured in. And we know there are many limitations when it comes to studying changes in dietary patterns, but also changes in weight. But there was one particular study that was released recently that stood out to me. And this is because the researchers had looked at weight loss, obviously during the study, but then they also went back at 6 months and 12 months to assess the participants and how they were progressing.
So the long-term follow-up,
yeah,
which is what we're always so interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. So it looked at a comparison of dietary macronutrient patterns for 14 popular named dietary programs. And they had a look.
I love that it was so easy to find 14.
I know. That's a lot.
It's a lot of diets.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm not surprised that there's that many.
I think there'd be even more.
Yeah.
That's probably tip of the iceberg diets.
And they'd be commonly accessed,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Definitely. And what they had a look at was weight-related outcomes and also cardiovascular risk factors. And it was a really high-quality study, so it was a systematic review and a meta-analysis of randomized trials. So high-quality study. They enrolled adults only, so you had to be over 18 years of age, and they only looked at people who were overweight or obese according to the BMI rating. So the outcome measures that they looked at was changes in body weight. They looked at our blood lipid profile, so LDL cholesterol, HDL and total cholesterol. They also looked at blood pressure and inflammatory markers as well. And as I said before, at 6 and 12 months after the trial. So there were 122 trials that made the cut for this meta-analysis. So there were close to 22,000 participants.
Big study.
Huge study. And Loz, as you mentioned, they had split the different dietary interventions into 3 main groups. So no surprise here, there was low carb. So that included things like Atkins, South Beach and Zone.
Yep.
There was also moderate macros, so a bit more balanced. And there are actually a couple of diets in there that I hadn't heard of. The Biggest Loser diet.
I mean, I've never really watched it.
Neither, so but apparently
sure
there is
a
diet. Jenny Craig, the Mediterranean diet, which we're a big fan of. Volumetrics is another one, and Weight Watchers.
Okay.
So a couple of different ones thrown in there. And then there was also a low-fat group. What was interesting is that the control group that they looked at, there were a couple of different interventions. So some of the participants stayed with their usual diet. They received brochures, dietary material, and also dietary guidelines. And some had professional support from a dietitian, either through email or telephone.
Just to eat normally?
Just to eat normally.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but with some support.
Yeah,
of just general healthy eating, dietary
probably
practices.
Probably so they didn't fall into a diet during the intervention.
Yeah, but I mean quite broad recommendations. Like
okay.
We know the dietary guidelines are good, but very general.
Yeah, for sure.
So the results, what was really interesting was that after 12 months, positive weight loss improvements diminished. So no surprise there. improvements in cardiovascular risk factors largely disappeared, except for improvements in LDL cholesterol on the Mediterranean diet. And no surprise there because of all of the healthy polyunsaturated fats.
So all of the diets at 12 months, no one sustained their weight loss.
Nope.
And the only benefit was with the cholesterol profile, the Mediterranean diet.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
In thousands of subjects.
Yeah, close to 22,000. So bottom line is diets are not effective in reducing weight in the long term. So whilst you might lose weight if you're doing a 12-week shred or a 12-week challenge, we know likely in 12 months' time, you'll have gained all that weight back.
Yeah. And we know actually from quite robust evidence elsewhere that reinforces that entirely, and that in many cases, not only do you regain it, you might even regain more than you started at originally. And very, very rarely is there what's considered grade A evidence in nutrition science. And anyone who's a science nut out there will
know that.
Will be with us on this. But there is grade A evidence in one element of nutrition, and that is that weight loss following lifestyle intervention is maximal at 6 to 12 months post that intervention. And regardless of the degree of the initial weight that's lost, most is regained within a 2-year period. And by 5 years, the majority of people are at their pre-intervention body weight.
Wow.
So very, very strong evidence to support that. And what that story tells us is that the intervention should never stop. And therefore, the intervention needs to be something that you can do forever.
And that's something we always harp on about to our patients. We don't want to put you on a diet or a particular intervention that you're going to do for a couple of weeks. We want to make long-term sustainable changes.
Mm. And I think so many diets are established with a goal of weight loss, generally around aesthetics, chronic disease risk, longevity. And we know that modest weight loss can improve a number of disease risk factors. There's solid evidence to support that. But we also know that there's some research to suggest that longevity might actually be at its peak with a BMI of 25 to 30, which would be considered overweight. And so we actually can't use body weight as a marker of health in general.
There are so many factors that come into play when we are looking at and assessing someone's health.
Hmm. And so why don't diets work? That's a question that we want to answer today, because there is certainly a combination not only of physiological reasons, which we've touched on before, and you're welcome to go back to episode 18 to explore that in a little bit more detail, but there's certainly a lot of psychology behind it as well.
Yeah, and one of the, I guess, main factors that comes into play is the dieting cycle. And many of you might be familiar with that. So I guess the first part of the cycle is that you enter a diet or a 12-week challenge or some sort of food restriction or dieting pattern.
Probably peak motivation.
Yeah. Yeah, you might have a goal of a wedding, summer's coming.
Feeling inspired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as the day, maybe the weeks go on, you start to feel a bit hungry because you are depriving your body of what it needs. As that deprivation gets worse, you eventually give in because it's human nature. We know that we are driven to get food when we're in a state of deprivation. So we eat to feel better, and then we temporarily start to feel better. And then after we've temporarily felt better, we start to get a bit down on ourselves and we're disappointed that we gave in or broke the diet. And then those negative emotions of guilt, stress, shame, anxiety, depression, poor self-esteem start to come into our head. And we start to feel so bad about ourselves that we end up getting back on the cycle again and start with the food restriction the next day. And some people can be stuck on this dieting cycle for years. And it's a path we think will make us feel better, but rather it often makes us feel worse. And people spend so much time, energy, money as well, riding the waves of this dieting cycle.
Absolutely. And like you said, it's very biological, that drive to eat to feel better, because when our body in particular, our brain is depleted of energy, or if we're losing weight rapidly or not even that rapidly, our body seeks to regain a balance and a homeostasis. And what's important to know is that it doesn't necessarily matter what you're eating or what food you're eating. If it's insufficient for your body's needs, you'll be driven to find more. And we know that there's a really important, area of weight loss that's not too much, to a point where you can actually sustain it without your body rebounding to go hunting for food out of necessity. Like we've spoken about before, if you're running out of oxygen, you are required to breathe. To ask you to not breathe is
inhumane
and really challenging.
Not possible.
And to ask someone who is hungry to not eat is exactly the same. And so you can't expect too much from yourself.
Yeah. And we know that someone who has a starved mind becomes even more obsessed with food. And that's the body's way of telling you, you need to eat.
Yeah, exactly. And similar to the yellow car effect when, and look, you probably, you bought a new car recently, right? And I don't know how many Mazdas you saw before you bought your Mazda, but as soon as you bought one or realised that you wanted one, they're everywhere. Yeah, and that's the yellow car effect. But the same thing happens with food. If someone, something is all of a sudden not allowed to be eaten, it's all you think about.
So much more appealing.
Yeah.
And anyone would know that if they said, oh, I'm cutting out sugar. It's like, well, that's not possible. And that is not something you're going to be able to do forever.
And I can tell you right now, all you're going to think about is sugar.
Exactly.
Which makes it far harder to actually fulfill that goal.
Yeah. So there's a part of our brain called the hypothalamus that acts almost like a thermostatic regulator to keep our weight stable. And it changes our hunger and satiety cues to make food more or less appealing. And it also changes our metabolic rate and hormones. Now, we can change the temperature in our house by opening the door when it's cold, which would cool the room down in the short term. But after a while, the thermostat would start to pick up that it was cold in the room and it would trigger the heater to start. It will keep pushing heat out for as long as it needs until the temperature returns back to normal.
So back to that point where you've said it, where it's meant to be.
Yeah.
Up or down, goes either way, doesn't
it? Exactly. And this is similar to calorie restriction. So as you play around with a stable temperature by keeping the door open, you don't make permanent change, and the heating and cooling are in constant battle with one another, which is really similar to dieting in that if we make a sudden and unsustainable change, our body will fight back and will fight hard to return it back to normal. And then the brain never stops trying to get our body back to where it's comfortable.
Yeah. And that is psychological, but very much biological as well. And there's so many mechanisms that drive that pathway. It's not you. It's human
our body.
Biology.
Yeah. And there's a huge psychological impact of that dieting and also weight stigma as well. So we know that those ongoing diet cycle and dietary patterns are more likely to result in disordered eating patterns or eating disorders. There's greater emotional eating, uncontrolled eating, and also a loss of sense of control. We know that body image and self-esteem is often tangled in there. There's psychological stress, and often this starts to affect relationships and can also increase anxiety, depression, and other sort of psychological conditions. So it's not a good place to be.
And it's interesting when you think about, you know, medicine, but also healthcare in general, it's first do no harm. And all of those things you've listed, they're pretty harmful.
Very harmful.
And so to embark upon a diet would be potentially contributing to quite a significant amount of harm with, according to the evidence, very little likelihood of return. So anything positive coming from it. Now, this all sounds really doom and gloom.
I know, we're not painting a very good picture, are we, Lars?
I guess what we want to really highlight is that diets don't work. No. And it's not you. It's not your willpower. It's not your ability to exhibit self-control. It is the way human bodies operate.
And it's also a diet culture that sells us this myth that we constantly need to change our body to look a certain way, and that the only way to feel good about yourself is through losing weight.
Yeah.
Which is so not the case.
It's that I'll be happy
when
scenario. I'll be happy when I can fit into my size 10s or
when I weigh 50 kilos.
Exactly. And I can tell you right now, when you get to that weight or you can fit into those jeans, there'll be something else. And it'll be then I'm happy when.
And I don't think I've ever heard someone say that they're happy with their weight. Often once they do get to their goal weight, they then move the benchmark even lower.
Yeah. And that's what you're used to in the world of individuals who are diet cycling.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's that inability to find harmony and contentment in your own skin, which is what we absolutely want to change the culture of.
So, look, it's not all about weight. Weight is not necessarily tied to health, and health can look different on everyone. I often say, you know, Loz, if we ate the same thing every day and did the same amount of physical activity, we would still look different.
Absolutely, we would.
And health looks different on both of us in very different ways.
And also similarly, if we ate the same thing every day, we'd still have very different cholesterol profiles because our bodies react in different ways to different things.
And we know that there are many different lifestyle factors that can predict health better than weight alone. And if a diet has a start and an end point, it's really unlikely to work. There are some factors that also predict health and that have an impact on the health status of an individual that people often don't think about. And that includes poverty, loneliness, our hormones and genetics, low levels of exercise. All of these factors all have an impact on our health to a much greater degree than just weight alone.
And interesting you mentioned loneliness. I think that's quite relevant at this point in time. I was looking quite deeply into research this week of the way our nutritional status changes when we eat alone versus with others and the impact that different individuals of different sex, of different profiles to you can impact on how much and what you choose to eat can be quite profound.
That's so interesting.
Fascinating. And in no culture in the world is solitary eating advocated for.
It's definitely not as much fun.
No. And that's, for a lot of people, really challenging at the moment who are perhaps living at home and don't have the opportunity to eat with others.
Mm.
And yeah, loneliness can play a big role in health.
I saw an excellent initiative on Facebook and Instagram the other day where people were getting together, so all over the world, for meal support.
Yeah,
so to eat with other people online, which is amazing.
So nice. So much nicer to share a meal with others. And look, so much wasted energy is spent on trying to change our weight and the way we look physically when we could really redirect that energy to something that can actually drive positive change and health improvement, whether it's around exercise, our mindfulness, our eating habits, our relationships, our work productivity. There are so many areas that we can direct our attention to that can have a positive impact on our health. And so what we want to bring to you guys now is, rather than focusing on the fact that diets don't work, is what actually does and what can you do to stimulate and sustain really positive change for good health long term, beyond 12 months.
Forever.
Yeah. And I'm going to give you some tips. The first one for you today is we want to try and encourage you to reduce your decision fatigue and reduce the reliance you have on your own willpower. Because many of you may be aware that willpower is actually a finite resource. We only have
so much
of it to spend each day. And tell you, I don't know about you, but I spend a lot of my willpower, deciding I'm going to get up today. I will have a shower. I will brush my teeth. I'll do that. And I won't spend the day watching Netflix. Instead, I'll go to work. And I won't spend the day with my dog. I will exercise first and then I'll go and do the things that I meant to do. That all takes significant willpower that
sure does.
You don't realize you're expending. You got to decide what to wear. You got to decide if you're going to put makeup on today.
You're going to wash your hair.
Yeah. And those decisions are constant throughout the day.
And fatiguing.
Fatiguing. They take willpower. It's morning tea and someone's passing around cookies. I'm going to say no to that today. But you know what can happen? Is that if you've expended all of your willpower throughout the day and then it gets to 9 o'clock and you run out of willpower, enter Tim Tams, ice cream.
Chocolate.
It's far harder to decline those food choices because you've expended all of your willpower.
Which is often why a lot of those eating practices happen at night when you're sitting on the couch because you've been through a whole day of work, as you said, making decisions, trying to resist certain things. And by the end of the day, you're exhausted.
Yeah. And I was looking into a really interesting study that was done with a group of dieters. So they're on a diet and it was looking into the impact of willpower and in an interesting way, psychological willpower. So these group of dieters were split into two groups and they were both asked to watch a really sad movie. And one group was allowed to react and respond emotionally as normal to the movie. And the other group was asked to suppress their emotions and not show any reaction to that really sad movie. They had to be completely neutral throughout. And so as you can imagine, it would be very exhausting to have to hold back those emotions through that movie.
And some people might not even be able to do that.
Yeah, well, it takes an inhumane request. Amount of willpower.
Yeah.
And at the end of the movie, the dieters were then presented with the opportunity to eat ice cream. And those that had to use all their willpower to suppress those emotions during the sad movie ate significantly more ice cream than those who are able to react freely to the movie. Oh,
that's so interesting.
Fascinating. And they followed up even further and looked into whether that was fatiguing, if it was fatigue physically or fatigue emotionally. And so they did some like sleep deprivation and similar studies looking at your food choices. And it was the emotional fatigue that was far more challenging.
And it makes sense. We've all been there.
Yeah.
We've all felt it.
And that's an extreme example. But if you have to suppress your emotion to your boss who's being a pain in the ass, or your, you know, in-laws who might be bothering you, or if you're getting niggling comments from people all day that you're not reacting to, then at 9 o'clock, you're going to be far less able to make those healthy food choices.
Mm. And the emotional eating would be real.
Yeah, very much so. So what to do? Reduce your decision fatigue. Wherever you can, create an environment for yourself where your day's decisions are easy. It might be that you know what you're going to wear already. You know what you're going to have for breakfast every day. Now, at least
we do that, don't we, Lars?
Do you eat the same breakfast every day?
Pretty much. Monday during Friday, the week, yeah.
I see you. You do.
Yep.
So do I. It's one thing I don't want to have to think about.
Yep.
Same goes for morning tea, for afternoon tea. You always have a capsicum in the afternoon.
And you have your carrot.
In the morning. We've got our, what I like to call the uniform, right? So make your decisions already made for you as wherever you can. And that's where meal prep can be quite a useful strategy.
It's one less thing you have to do and think about. You don't have to think about
it. And I've read this recently, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that President Obama only ever wore blue or a grey suit because he didn't want to ever have to think about what he was going to wear.
I heard that from you, so okay. I'm going to take your word for it.
I could be spinning lies here. But
it makes sense. It's a reasonable practice.
With the full intention that he didn't want his decisions to go towards his wardrobe. He wanted them to go towards running
the
country.
Much bigger things.
Yeah.
I wonder if Donald Trump has the same procedure in place.
Unlikely. Often there's a really raging red tie, which... Anyway, we won't go there. It's not a political podcast. So create a uniform, reduce decision fatigue, and allow yourself to help have willpower at the end of the day, because it is a finite resource. Number two is do it for you and yourself, and explore the reasons why you want to lose weight, not at the surface, but really actually deep down. So is it for the wedding or the reunion, or is it actually because of the way you feel about yourself and the way you want people to perceive you?
Because there's a lot of work that needs to be done underneath all that.
Yeah. It's very easy to cover up with, oh, I want to feel better in my jeans or fit into that dress.
Yeah.
But why? What is it about your body at the moment that
you're not
satisfied with? Mm. And what would fitting into those jeans bring to you that you couldn't gain here and now today?
And from something else. Yeah. From being with a loved one, from reading a good book, from doing some yoga.
Yeah. And that's hard to uncover by yourself. And we spend a lot of our time uncovering and getting really deep into people's reasons why. Because if you can get down deep, you can actually create change in a lot more of a meaningful way.
Because finding your why and what drives you is so important when setting goals.
Absolutely. Another really important thing to consider is that it is emotions that create habits. And what we want to do is we want to use positivity to fuel good behavior. Now, research demonstrates that the feeling of success is more likely to drive positive change than actually achieving your goal.
Wow.
So, standing on the scale and seeing it drop 2 kilos means less than having eaten that carrot every morning because you said you were going to do so. So allow yourself to feel really good about the behavior that you're doing. And one way to do that is to make your goals incredibly, stupidly easy to achieve.
We've spoken about that so many times.
Yeah.
Walking to the letterbox.
Walking to the letterbox, doing 2 squats when you brush your teeth. Rather than, you know, saying you're going to eat healthily or eat more veggies, just
start on Monday.
Yes. Have a carrot every second day or one bite of an apple every day. You can keep going if you want, but if you have that
bite, to achieve those goals.
You've done it. Big gold star, well done. You can pat yourself on the back and you can fuel that good, positive, successful behavior. One other thing that I think is a really lovely way to reframe the way we look at our body was a suggestion that I heard from an American social scientist, BJ Fogg. And one of his suggestions with regard to behavior change and driving that positivity was around how to actually look at your body and provide yourself with some positive feedback. Now, his suggestion was in the morning, or in the evening when you're having your shower and you turn the shower on, you have to wait for it to heat up, right? There's a thermostat. Go back to that. As you wait for that shower water to get warm, I want you to use that time to think of one thing that is positive about your body.
I really like that. I'm going to start doing it.
I'm going to start doing it too. Because if you start your day or finish your day whenever you have your shower with that feeling of positivity and gratitude for yourself and what your body can do, you're far more likely to want to nurture it.
And positive affirmations are huge. We know how helpful they can be in creating sustainable change and motivation.
And then rather than going and punishing yourself by going on a low-fat or a low-carb diet, you might actually want to nurture yourself, nourish yourself with good food that makes you feel good, not just now, not just in 12 months, but forever.
Yeah.
And that's all we have time for this week. Thanks for listening in and we hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you drop by and say hi on the Encore Nutrition website, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Just search Encore Nutrition. We absolutely want to hear from you and encourage everyone to join in on the conversation. Now, it's important to say that while Lauren and Elise are very knowledgeable on the world of diet and nutrition, we always encourage you to speak with your medical expert to ensure that the advice is right for you. And we'll be back next week to break down all things food, diet, nutrition, and lifestyle.